Confident in his abilities, poised to play the game, determined to win the gold. Tonight, Triple H must defend his title to earn the illustrious championship handed to him out of corporate spite and accept it with personal grief. The WWE Championship. Soaked in the blood of its previous proprietors. Yet the current and most dominant controller has remained unscathed, ready to eliminate all that stand in his way.
Nobody can beat me!
A decade of destruction. Teaching pain is a lesson given to those who walk too close to his yard.
Tonight's got nothing to do with business. This is strictly personal.
Tonight, The Undertaker looks to take first blood, but Brock Lesnar seeks to dispose of another legend. On this night, we shall all bear witness to history. Two championship matches, one night. A night where the mighty will rise and the meek shall remain unforgiven.
And now, Castrol GTX presents WWE Unforgiven.
North-South Connection Podcast Network. Welcome to the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast, episode number 32. You're in the low 30s, wow. It is a pay-per-view episode, which is always exciting, as tonight we'll be covering Unforgiven 2002. I will bring in my guests right from the get-go, and so we can talk this out and start working through this loaded show. So my guest is one of my most frequent guests on this podcast, but he has never been on for a pay-per-view, so this will be a first for him. He is, you can find him on the Place to Be Nation Pop Experience, doing the Blockbuster Rewind. I'm sure he'll tell you that's the main podcast I know he does. He does a ton of guest spots all over our different podcasts, but that would be my good buddy, Mr. Scott Shiflett, the Shifter, Shifferoonie.
I'm gonna
bust out the Shipper Rooney tonight. Jambalaya Jake, I'm happy to finally be on a podcast. I was here 7 times. I finally got my punch card for the pay-per-view. I am prepared for this one, and it's very interesting to say the least.
Yes, it is. We'll go through it. This is, I think the show has a little bit of a reputation as we'll get through it in this, and we'll see, as with a lot of stuff as I've been going through this podcast, with nearly 20 years of hindsight, it does kind of, you know, sometimes I wonder with these that our feelings about them are so caught up in the time, and I feel like sometimes my feelings change with the benefit of hindsight, and I feel like this might end up being one of those shows in some ways. Some ways, not so much. I think it's the I kind of go what I feel is the prevailing opinion, but we'll get to it as we get to it. But like you said, I'm glad you accumulated enough Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast reward points to finally be able to get your pay-per-view, because these are high commodities. People come at me quite ahead of time to do the pay-per-views, and nobody had really called this one, so I thought you earned it, Shiv.
Thank you so much. They're completely missing out with this this pay-per-view, because it has one of the best matches I think I've seen in years that I'd never seen before, which we'll get to. So an underrated gem. I mean, it might be properly rated. I don't know. I've never seen it before, so I'm happy to be here as always, Jake.
Yeah, this is a weird one in that, you know, as my guest Gruny said a couple episodes ago, that it is September, which is historically sort of a down month a little bit. They're trying to reset a bit after SummerSlam. And this show is sort of sandwiched between two very well-known shows. Obviously, SummerSlam 02 is like historically one of the, you know, it's a super well-known show, considered one of their greatest of all times. If not, you know, you could argue it. You know, there's an argument they made it could be their greatest show of all time. And then you have No Mercy, which has some really well-known matches that's going to follow this. So this one's kind of sandwiched in there and maybe gets forgotten a little bit. Or if it is remembered, it's remembered for some of the not-so-positive things that people remember from the show. But as always, we'll hash it out and see how we feel. Before we start, we don't have
Jake, I'm sorry to cut you off. Would you say that's 2002 in a nutshell? Like, some really good things and then some things that are, like, when you're watching it, you pray that, like, you know, if I was 13 when this show came out, I was like, I really hope my mom doesn't come in here at this moment. And there's times now where I'm like, I really hope my wife doesn't come in here. But there's times where it's like, this is why wrestling is great. So I think that's, like, really 2002 in a nutshell.
It is. And it's the brand split thing. Yeah. But the definitely post-SummerSlam really doubling down on some of the hope my mom doesn't walk in while I'm watching it material. With the HLA and the Billy and Chuck wedding. And certainly there's something coming in the next month leading up to No Mercy that is an all-timer in that department that I won't talk about much now. But yeah, it's certainly a mixed bag in every aspect, whether it be the match quality, the angles, everything. But I think overall it's been, and I think the trend continues. At worst, I think it's pretty solid, and at best, really good. So we'll get through it. But one thing I want to talk about, we don't have a lot of news and notes from this because it is the same week as the Raw and SmackDown it just covered on the last episode. So it's not a whole lot of news and notes that differ from what we just talked about. I do have one, but it kind of relates directly to one of these matches. So I'll talk about when we get to the actual match. But I do want to say, Chip, that finally, as of the day we were recording this, it seems that SmackDown is finally being put up on Peacock, thankfully. It was Raw went up pretty quickly, but for the purposes of me doing this podcast and anybody who is, you know, listening, hopefully, and likes to follow along. I know I do when I listen to podcasts. I like to be, if I can, I like to sort of watch along with it so I have a fresh frame of reference for it. So if anybody is, and I've had some people reach out to me on Twitter and stuff saying, like, oh, how are you watching the SmackDown? So, I have been, of course, using my vacation home in outside of Paris, France, my internet account from France to do it. But it seems like I'll be able to drop that. So that is some definite positive news, Scott.
Yeah, it's great news. I'm glad you can finally sell your vacation home in Paris. I know the charges were starting to run up on you. But, yes. You know, people were upset with, you know, as we, you know, call it the cock, with not putting everything up immediately, but I think they've made pretty good time. I mean, they moved over in April, and now it's June, and mostly everything's up. I mean, I know Sean Kidd's upset because we don't have 80s NWA, but hopefully that'll be put up soon. But they've put a decent amount up, and, you know, they're moving at a pretty good pace, especially this week when we're recording.
Yeah, they're getting to the point where most of the heavy hitters are taken care of. And for all the hoopla over the censoring stuff, I mean, considering the stuff I just covered, I don't think they've gone too harsh with the censors, you know, with all the HLA and all this stuff that I've covered recently. And it's all pretty much kept intact, aside from things that I think were copyright issues, like the It's Raining Men thing. They just had to take out because they didn't have the rights to the song, I assume. But yeah, so that's been, yeah, most of the heavy hitters are showing up on there. And considering the timeline, like you said, that it was SummerSlam, I think they're doing okay. So hopefully it all gets there. Hopefully Sean gets his wish and they put up all the old NWA stuff. But so that's some good news for anybody who follows along with the pod. But going off of that, we will go right into the show. Scott, so we are going to be covering Unforgiven 2002, which is live from the Staples Center in LA. So pretty top flight venue for them. And this is a huge crowd, too. I want to say this is like 16,000, which I'd imagine with the staging and all. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's got to be, if not a sellout, pretty close to a sellout for them here in LA, which makes sense. I mean, it's a huge market pay-per-view. They're still pretty hot right now, even though their business is trending down a little bit. They're still, I think, pretty hot as a promotion. We get our a solid, like, grandiose opening, real melodramatic, as you expect from these, in the best possible way. I love these. I miss these. I'm glad they're still going on even in 2002, because I think we associate them with the 90s, but they're still around here. Like, at one point, they talk about the Triple H and RVD angle, and they have this great, like, a classic line you would hear in these, like, a hand it to him out of corporate spite, you know. Always love those lines like that.
Oh, no, it's great. Like, I even have a note here. It says, like, dope video package. Like, I could spend hours watching these video packages. And I have spent hours watching video packages on YouTube before, you know, the network was a thing. So it's just a nice little nostalgia thing that I wish they would actually go back to in current wrestling. But, yeah, and while we're talking about Triple H, it still pisses me off that he just got handed the title. I mean, I know that was what they were was supposed to do, but damn, it just pisses me off, Jake.
Yeah, it's been a topic that we've been covering on the pod since it happened. I'm sure it's going to be one that's going to continue throughout his reign. But yeah, I've said my feelings on it. I totally get it. And it's, I think in a vacuum, it could be an interesting angle, you know, but it's what they do with it. And this is an important show because this is his first real defense on pay-per-view since being gifted the title. So this is really going to give us an indication. There's been some troubling signs on TV already, but we'll see how this match plays out because this is going to maybe give us a window into what, you know, how this title reign is going to go for Triple H after he was handed the belt out of corporate spite, as the video package just told us. But anyway, we start off after that great opening. We get our normal pyro cool set. Still have the unique set to this point. This one is like, I don't know, a bunch of metal and crap. It's just like a huge, looks like almost like a metal box or something like that. But we come out right at the gate with our opening match, which will be a Raw match. It's going to be the Un-Americans. It's going to be an 8-man tag, I should say, with the Un-Americans versus Booker T and Goldust, Bubba Ray Dudley, and Kane. The Un-Americans, of course, are our Canadians, Tess, Christian, and Storm, and now they have recently been joined by William Regal, who I think is a perfect fit for this team, given their anti-American sentiments. So we start off, we get a real big shine sequence for the faces to start off here, with kind of all of them getting their spots in to get the crowd nice and revved up. And so finally, which is typical of these matches with the with Booker T and Goldust, Goldust ends up being the one who gets isolated for a minute. So the Un-Americans start picking apart Goldust, using some slight underhanded tactics here and there, kind of distracting the ref and double teaming and all that sort of stuff. Finally, he tags in Booker T, who gets in. He starts lighting him up. Again, typical of Booker T and Goldust in this run. This is kind of how they function for the most part. Goldust is the face in peril. Booker T comes in, starts lighting everybody up with his kicks and kind of his kind of flashy offense. we get, and I enjoyed the pace right from the get-go on this. They really came out with a quick pace, like I said, with the shine sequence and then going right into Goldust getting beat down. And good crowd involvement right from the start, because like I said, they get the crowd into it, and then the crowds, but by doing the shine sequence first, then they get the crowd behind them, so they're steady behind Goldust. And so I thought right from the jump, they had a good good energy to this match. So we continue on. Booker and Bubba go for a table, but it gets drop kicked into their face, and kind of they start working them over. Kane finally is able to come in. He cleans house again for the Americans. Booker T is in. He hits a scissors kick on Tess, which gets a huge reaction, and things are really starting to break down here, as they do typically in these multi-man matches like this. And Kane ends up getting low-blowed. And by this point, I just called this. I'm not going to see everything that happened here, Scott. I called it like a full-on get-your-shit-in scrum, where every guy's just running in, hitting their big moves, and just, you know, one guy flies in, a heel flies in, he hits somebody, then the face comes in, cuts him off, which I think works in this type of match. Sometimes it irritates me, but I think it worked okay in this one. It didn't drag on too long. But anyway, the Americans end up winning because Kane ends up being the last one to hit a move in the sequence. He hits Storm with the choke slam and ends up pinning him, which, again, it makes me wonder, why are Storm and Christian even the tag champs? They don't really get protected as tag champs a lot. They rarely have tag matches where they're defending the tag, the championship, because now it's become like factions against factions sort of thing. Or, you know, like this, an eight-man or a six-man is a lot of what they're doing. So it's weird because they're tag champs, but they've already gotten beaten up by Kane in a two-on-one match, in a handicap match. Now they, you know, Storm takes the pin in this one for whatever reason. Why you'd have him take the pin and not Regal is beyond me, because Regal doesn't have much going on. But as it was, I thought it was a fun kind of high-energy opener. It has pretty easy face and heel lines drawn through it for the crowd to get behind. And some guys that are really over on both sides, the Un-Americans as heels, and then some really popular faces, especially Booker T and Kane. I thought the crowd was really behind them. But I like the energy of it. It was a good way to start the show. I went 3 stars on it, Scott.
Yeah, Jake, I went 3 stars too. I mean, the crowd, just see them like get more and more behind Booker T, especially since you started this pod. It's just a delight. He was fucking over like a rover. In that, and I will give it to the crowd. They stay hot the whole night, and like it starts here. I mean, I think there's only one let me up match, and that's the women's match, which I know you'll be finally happy. Hopefully that feud's put to bed. Spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'll say even Bubba Ray wasn't that bad, and I do believe because you mentioned this last episode with Bradshaw getting hurt, that definitely had to be Bradshaw's spot that they just slid Bubba Ray into, because he, you know, wasn't really dealing with the Un-Americans. So, you know, they had to have someone in there. You know, they good heat. And I will say they did make Tess look kind of like a badass, because he hits the pump handle slam on Kane, which is really impressive, because, you know, I always think, like, you know, Tess was always like mid-card. I'm not saying he could be like a main eventer, but he could always, I think he could have been like an upper main, like, you know, challenging for the IC or US title when that comes in, but like it just never clicked. Or maybe he just should have been a Haas in a tag team, because he looked very good when he was in this match, in my opinion. Kane just, Booker T's, like I said, is over like wherever. He's like supernova over. Like, crowd's loving that he's back, you know, which we'll see with, you know, what's going to happen with in your next couple of episodes with Memory Serves. But he's just, God, he looks so great there. I went 3 stars as well. It was a hell of a match, and I was like, oh, I'm looking to see what happens with this pay-per-view since we started off so hot.
Yeah, it's a perfect place for this match, to have an opening, just a big multi-man match. Like I said, tons of guys who are over in here. Yeah, Kane, this has actually been a pretty solid tune-up, kind of little feud for him coming back off his injury, just to kind of get him back in the fold and get the crowd used to seeing him again. And it also, if they want to present him as a face, it definitely helps him, because anybody who's against the Un-Americans is going to be treated like a face, and they're fired up because he's back. So that's been pretty good. The Un-Americans continue to be, it's starting to be like, how much shelf life are they going to have? Because
it's dwindling quickly, because they went from being, I think the last time I was on is when they defected, and they had nuclear crowd heat, and it's just like, they're still getting it, but like, they're not even like, when I was on last time, they fucking took out the Undertaker and buried him under the flag. So it's like, what's going on? Like, and now since then, they can't even beat Kane 2-on-1. They're getting their ass beat every week, it seems like. But I don't even know who you would make tag champions, because it's not like we had a robust tag division on Raw at this time. I mean, I guess Booker T and Goldust, but, you know, like, who are they going to feud with? The Un-Americans. So they're stuck in a rock in a hard place. Personally, I would have personally kept the tag titles on SmackDown and just had Billy and Chuck, since you were supposed to trying to, you know, push Slim as like the uber male, you know, baby face that, you know, they were trying to, you know, prove that they weren't, you know, gay. So it was like, why even move them, you know?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, if they're not with Storm and Christian, I don't even know what you do with them, because you really don't have a tag division. It's just, so I guess they just put them on where, because they're like, well, we have nothing else to do with them, so it'll maybe make the Un-Americans look stronger. But yeah, the Un-Americans, I think the issue is that they never had a lot of time to really build them up as any kind of real threat. It's like they talked a big talk and got the heel heat, you know, with their talking, but they didn't really do a whole lot. They never really had anything close to being like a dominant stable or a threat. They kind of just became fodder for all these faces, which is fine. It's just, it's going to have a shelf life, because eventually no one's going to take them very seriously anymore. And they're going to, it's going to end up like this, where they're kind of just fodder for these guys. So I don't remember how long they last, but it doesn't seem like it could go on too much longer. I feel like the end of this is probably going to be Booker T and Goldust winning the titles. That's kind of what you would think. And I hope that they start focusing on that chase a little bit more, because the Un-American stuff has got a little convoluted, and that it just seems like every mid-card guy on the Raw, every mid-card face who doesn't have anything to do just starts feuding with the Un-Americans. And I'd like to see them focus a little bit more and get it back to the Booker T and Goldust stuff, because it was kind of fun seeing them chase the titles. And we've kind of taken a little bit of a break from that. So I hope they head back to it. But anyway, we'll continue on with the show. We head backstage. Stephanie is with Billy and Chuck, trying to give them a pep talk. She tells them this match against Jamal and Rosie's Night is about pride and redemption. And then Chuck chimes in saying, it's also so you don't have to French kiss a lesbian later, which was kind of a funny line. Pretty good. It was good timing on that one by Chuck.
It was good timing. But it's just like watching it back, and like you have to watch with like your hands over your eyes peeking through. It's rough.
Yeah, every time they talk about lesbians in here, it's very dehumanizing, because they call them like a lesbian, like the lesbians, you know, like it's very, you know, it's not really how you refer to people, you know. So I agree, uncomfortable. But his timing and just the absurdity. I like the juxtaposition of how serious Stephanie is, and then he just makes this dumb comment.
Oh yeah, it's like the best thing Chuck's probably ever done was listen to that theme song. So I can't really hate on him for that.
And I just throughout this whole thing, it's just typical with Vince stuff. Anything to do with Stephanie here, just the fact that Vince is the head honcho, and even though maybe he's not the one who came up with this whole angle, I mean, as we know, all this stuff gets cleared through Vince. So it's just funny, like them going, all right, Vince, so we got this angle where Stephanie, it's going to be the whole thing is that we're all supposed to be hoping that she has to make out with these lesbians. Like, oh, love it, pal. This is great.
It's especially considering the storyline that supposedly got nixed, where Stephanie's child was going to be Vince's or Shane's. It's extremely odd. But I will say, you know, Stephanie looked amazing tonight. Looking damn good, in my opinion.
She rarely doesn't. She rarely doesn't.
That's very true. But tonight, it was like, Jesus. All right, Trips. I see you working.
All right. So we'll see what happens later in that big. We'll see. Will she have to participate in some HLA? But anyway, we head to our next match, which is going to be Chris Jericho, our newly minted Intercontinental Champion, after he got it from RVD through nefarious means on Raw. And he's going to be facing Flair, who he's been feuding with off and on. This will be a rematch from SummerSlam. So we start off, Flair struggles a bit in the early going, but he picks off Jericho off the top rope and then goes to work on him. Jericho quickly comes back, drop kicking him from the apron, followed by another drop kick. I really liked how they established early on in this match that Jericho's going to go a lot more for like the aerial moves, to kind of show his cockiness, almost like he's trying to put in Flair's face, like, I know you can't do this stuff like I can, because a lot of this, the whole feud is about Jericho saying that Flair's a has-been and whatnot. So I thought it kind of fit their feud to have him, to really put a contrast between Flair just doing his normal kind of Flair stuff with the chops and everything, while Jericho's hitting all these missile drop kicks and that sort of thing. And that it's kind of throwing Flair off because it's not really his thing. And that Flair is not on his A game, and so throwing him off a little bit more. I thought that was some decent storytelling. But we keep going. It gets a little bit more grounded now as Jericho locks in the ab stretch. Flair fires back with some chops and throws, ends up throwing Jericho completely over the ring post. I thought that was a really nice bump as he flew out to the outside of the ring. Jericho gets his way back up to the top, but before he can do anything, Flair runs up to him, punches him in the thigh. I thought that was a nice gritty spot. Again, that's one of my favorite parts about this match is just the way they were able to contrast the two styles. I thought they did, and the time they were given, I thought they built that pretty well into the story of the match. And I kind of liked how, as the match went on, like after he kind of gets used to, you know, is able to kind of weather some of Jericho's stuff, all these drop kicks and stuff, you could see Flair's confidence sort of building as the match goes on. I thought that was a nice touch too, by Flair, who obviously is, you know, he's good at the subtleties of wrestling.
He's pretty good.
So good character stuff by Flair. But then as he's really working him over, we have a spot where Jericho injures his knee, and he starts cowering towards the ropes and goes to the corner. And so Flair starts to become a little hesitant, thinking that Jericho's injured. And the ref really is almost blocking Flair from really doing any kind of offense. While Jericho's injured, they end up calling in the trainers. And of course, while the trainers are coming out, the ref's distracted. He ends up blocking Flair in the walls of Jericho. And then Flair ends up tapping and losing the match. Before I get into my overall thoughts, what did you think of this? Obviously, the focus of the match is the finish. So what did you think of this finish, Scott?
I hated it. It killed the match for me. Like, I was enjoying the match. Like, I have notes here, like, you know, Flair was chopping the shit out of Jericho. Like, you could hear it. I liked, you know, Flair also working the leg. I thought that was a nice little old school thing. And then, you know, they do the thing where, you know, I will give it to Y2J. He did come down, looked like he did hurt the knee, so it wasn't like out of nowhere. But then, like, the ref is there doing it, and then, like, they call out the trainer and they pan to the trainer. And by that point, like, Jericho has Flair flipped over in the walls, and I was just like, this is a chicken shit ending. And this is sadly not the last of the chicken shit endings we'll get tonight, which it's okay for some, but three or four times in a mat in a night, I just don't agree with. And this was the start of it.
Yeah. What'd you go in the match star rating wise?
This is probably, you know, I'm probably going to catch shit for this, but I went 2.25. The ending took it out that much from me.
No, I mean, I'm not much higher. I don't think that'll be too controversial. I went 2.5 for sort of the same reasons. And I think it's going to be something as we go through this card is that, I think the idea behind the finish is not the worst thing in the world. It's just the execution was not great. Like, I don't mind, because that is the story, you know, whether you think it's a dumb story or not, Flair being off his game or whatever, or not being what he used to be. But if that is the story you're going with, and, you know, Jericho, I just think you have to, because here, to me, Flair doesn't really even come off looking that bad here. It doesn't even really feel like he's making much of a mistake. It just maybe feels like the old Flair wouldn't have cared what the ref said, and this one does. But to me, the one who really comes off like a dope is the ref. Like, Flair is kind of just having to deal with the ref being a moron, because, like, why wouldn't the ref, when he turns around, isn't he, like, shocked to see Jericho has him in the walls? Like, shouldn't he be like, hey, wait, I thought you tore your ACL. Like, how are you up? But then instead he's like, oh, boy, he's tapping. Oh, well, fuck.
Ring the bell. Lost.
Yeah, like, so to me, Flair didn't come off that. So that's what I mean. It's just, it's some stupid reffing. It's not the smoothest way of doing it. I think there's probably better ways you could have got across the same point where it wouldn't have come off as goofy as this, where, like, why would the ref not do anything? Why would he just be like, well, guess he miraculously recovered, but then the ref, like, was actively stopping Flair from hitting him. So the ref kind of screwed Flair in this one. If anything, you should be really pissed off at the ref. That's how I left the match.
Yeah, they could have done like a small thing where you like you see like Jericho like paying the ref off for acting with him, you know, later like in the back or something. Just that would make it, you know, infinitely times better because the ref comes off like a moron, like you said.
Yeah, and I think if they were trying to go for it, that Flair isn't as aggressive as the old Flair would have been. I don't know if it really came through enough. I think they needed to hammer that home a little bit because I think that works better. Like you say, well, the old Flair, like Flair in the 80s would have never, he wouldn't have cared what the ref said. He would have pushed the ref out the way and kicked the guy in the leg until the stretcher came, until they carted his ass out, you know? And I kind of get that. That's a fine enough story for what they're going. You know, if that's where you want to go with Flair, I think that works. But in this, it just came off as it just got real messy and didn't work too well. But I really enjoyed what they did up to this point. So that's with a 2.5. I think it could have been much better with a better finish because I don't mind that as a story for the match. It's just the execution left a little to be desired. Won't be the last time I say that on the show. But yes. We continue on. We now see Eric Bischoff with his boys with a 3-minute warning, Rosie and Jamal. He's hyping them up. He says that he's going to have Rico, who has been his mole throughout this entire thing, his right-hand man. He's going to manage them because he knows Billy and Chuck inside out, which, you know, inside and out. Get it? But anyway, Rico says that Eric Bischoff can get some popcorn and Vaseline, which gets a strange look from Eric Bischoff. But Rico says it so he can watch HLA later. So he's alluding to Eric Bischoff masturbating during the segment later.
Yeah, it's not good. But I will say Bischoff comes off, like you mentioned this before, he plays slimy so well. Like, it's, you know, I mean, this was also the guy that was watching his wife get down in the Gold Club. So.
Yeah, so. He plays this role great, and I think he elevates a lot of this stuff to at least make it entertaining for as absurd as it is, or, you know, not completely sensitive. We get to see Shaquille O'Neal's in the house, Shaq's in the house, since we are in L.A., riding high off this would be fall 2002, so they had already three-peated, I want to say, right, Scott? Remember that?
Yeah, him and like, Kobe hated each other.
Yes, they were fresh off the three-peat, and that House of Cards would soon tumble down as things would kind of fall apart for them in the next couple of years. But at this point, they're on top of the world after the three-peat. So Shaq's in the house, still looking very young, even though, you know, he's not, you know, this is not Orlando Shaq, but, you know, compared to what you're used to seeing him today, he looks very young.
I mean, go back and watch Shaq highlights from the early 2000s. The man was unstoppable. I know I'm getting off target, but
oh no, absolutely, he has struck fear into the hearts of basketball players throughout the NBA in the late 90s, early 2000s. But anyway, he's in the house. Noted big wrestling fan, Shaq. But anyway. We now head to another rematch here. This is going to be Edge versus Eddie Guerrero. There was a pretty good build to this on. Pretty good build on SmackDown to this with, even though they didn't have a whole lot of time to build it, I really liked Eddie's work on SmackDown when he had Edge busted open, grabbed him by the head. We covered that last week. Really good hype to this match. I was hoping the comments, so a lot of this match is centered around Edge having a concussion that he suffered like 3 days ago, and I'm hoping that's kayfabe.
Yeah, knowing them at the time, it probably wasn't. Yeah, hearing them like talk about concussions so blasé is because I'm pretty sure we even knew a little bit that concussions were not as much as we know now, of course, but like Jesus, it's yeah. But I will say like on the SmackDown side of the house, their matches have been built up great, and like with the Raw side, we've already seen two matches so far. With the Un-Americans, it's just like, oh, let's just get four baby faces that really aren't doing anything and just throw them out there. So we're seeing a contrast with that already. I mean, Flair and Y2J has been built up, but, you know, had that crappy ending and it left a sour taste in my mouth.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be, this being the first SmackDown match on the card, really sets the tone for what the prevailing kind of SmackDown style is right now, as far as being a lot about athleticism and kind of... in certain ways, like a more old school way of storytelling, like an old kind of you know, limb work and that kind of thing that kind of comes into play. This is why I mentioned the concussion at the beginning, because it's the main, it's the focus throughout this entire match. So we start off Eddie. I love this, and I always say this about Eddie, but he always does all these little things. That's why he's one of the greatest ever. But like in this one, he knows Edge is going to be pissed off and come in super hot. So he ducks out right at the beginning. It's not really like your typical like stalling and walking around the ring for too long. It's just for just a few seconds. He knows Edge is going to be going right for him. So he just rolls out of the ring really quick, just to avoid that early onslaught. And then he goes back in, which Edge does get a little bit of advantage. Like he hits him pretty quickly. He hits the kind of, he hits a suplex. He hits that flapjack move. That's like kind of one of his signatures at this time. But then right after this, after he gets a little bit, Eddie catches him really quick. He hits a tornado DDT, gets a little bit of a breather. And then he realizes after he hits the DDT that that's going to be his, like, that's his end right there. That it's, he's going to go after the neck and head and work on him because of the concussion, which again, hopefully,
that fingers this crossed.
That this is for storytelling purposes and that Edge didn't really have a concussion. We'll just hope. But anyway, so he realized the weakness. He starts stomping on Edge's head, really great, vicious stomps. He puts in some really cool, like an interesting headlock variation where he kind of pins Edge's arms down with his legs and then does a face lock, which I thought, again, all these little things that, you know, that make him as great as he is, that he doesn't just put in a normal headlock, but he holds down the legs with his, I mean, holds down the arms with his legs so Edge can't kind of punch him or get out in that way. Then he kind of moves into a face lock. Edge fires up a little bit, but Eddie forearms him to kind of keep him back down. And just, I love how strategic Eddie is throughout this entire match. Like I said, once he realizes his end, that he wants to focus on the head, it's like he's very deliberate in everything he does. As you go through this match, I would say there's not, he doesn't waste a ton of spots. Everything he does has a purpose. He knows what he's trying to do, which is really awesome. And kind of, it gets you invested in the match. But anyway, Edge can't get a break as Eddie, he ups the intensity here as he gets a lot more vicious with attacks. Again, I just pointed out, I love the commentary here too. And Cole and Taz are so good at the style of these SmackDown matches because they're pointing out all this stuff that I'm saying about Eddie going after the head, how deliberate he is. So great job on commentary of getting the story of the match over. Edge finally grabs some offense by getting a quick roll up and hitting a neck breaker. And another thing I love throughout this match, guys, is the way, like the momentum shifts in here felt really right whenever they would hit him. Like whenever Edge would have his little hope spots throughout, I thought it felt really good. Like it made a lot of sense and you could really feel the momentum swing back and forth in a cool way, which I think is a hard thing to pull off in matches.
Yeah, it flowed it flowed very nice, like with, like you said, like with them going back and forth. Like it felt like a basketball game, really, like when you see like a team make a run and then like, oh, how's the other one gonna respond? And that's how this like felt, especially when like we get towards the end, which you're about to get to. But yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with that.
Yeah, and it didn't feel like they were just going back and forth trading moves. It really felt like it was trading the advantage. Like the basketball game is a good way of saying, like, as like Eddie would go on a run and then Edge would kind of get a few in. But I have to say, Eddie dominated a lot of this match. But as Edge is finally getting a little bit of momentum, Eddie brings it back by cracking him with a nice jawbreaker. Eddie then goes to do his kind of tightrope Rana move that he always does, and Edge counters that to a really nice sit-out powerbomb. He goes for the spear, but Eddie avoids it. He ends up hitting the execution, but he's too close to the ropes, and Eddie's able to get a foot on the ropes. Edge goes for a dropkick, misses that. During that, Eddie exposes the turnbuckle, but then it backfires on him as Edge hits the spear this time and spears Eddie right into it, and Eddie sells the back like he just got shot. They go back up top as Edge brings him up to the top rope, but Eddie is able to counter by smashing his face onto the exposed buckle, which I thought was another awesome spot. Just to use that twice in the match, I thought was really good and a creative way for Eddie to counter it there. And then he hits a sunset flip powerbomb, and when he hits it, he drives Edge's neck straight into the mat to really hammer home the whole focus of the match has been on the head and the neck and everything. And so, and then he ends up getting the pin, which I thought was awesome because Eddie, you know, certainly takes a lot of losses in, you know, in a lot of these matches. So it's nice to see him have a win. And again, I love that the way he won by doing that sunset flip and a sunset flip powerbomb off the top rope and just slamming Edge's, you know, just to remember, it just kind of is an exclamation point of what the whole match was really about. But I really thought this match was awesome. Scott, I thought Edge's selling was really good. I know Edge sometimes is a guy that is known for being a little hammy in his facial expressions and his selling, but I thought he did it pretty well here. He didn't get over ridiculous with the acting woozy kind of thing where he was getting all out of control with it. So I thought he was good. And Eddie was just excellent this match. He was so relentless. Even when Edge would fire back at him, he stayed focused and then ended up paying off for him as he won. By hitting that power bomb in the end. Just awesome stuff. I went 3.5 on this. I really, really enjoyed this.
Yeah, this match was a banger. I enjoyed the shit out of this match. Like you said, like just the little stuff that Eddie does is like one of the things that makes him so great. Because I admit, like at the time I was watching, I was like, you know, Eddie Guerrero is a guy. But like going back with like, you know, adult eyes and like seeing it like, you know, as a, you know, somehow a bigger wrestling fan than I was at 13 years old. Obviously I'm doing a podcast about it, but, just seeing like the little stuff, like with, like you said, like he saw the end with like the head and the neck and just worked it the whole time. He didn't even win with the frog splash. He won with that power bomb was disgusting that mm-hmm. Eddie hit. And also the sit down power bomb that Edge did that hit I bit on that. I thought he was going to win. And, you know, one of my favorite tropes in wrestling is when the heel undoes the turnbuckle and then mm-hmm. is the one that gets hit with it. So I love that. But I also love that Eddie was still able to win because, like, it was just like his back that got screwed up. Like, he didn't get hit in the head with it. I went 3.75 stars on this. This match was great. Like, you know, I wish, like, I know with everything that happens with Eddie, I wish we would have had a main event feud of Edge versus Eddie. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was awesome. And like you said, with the there's so many little things, like, you know, like not finishing with the frog splash because this made more sense given the story of the match that he would do something that would attack the head is awesome. Kind of throwing you, kind of doing the, like they go with the typical, well, the heel does the buckle and it backfires on him, but then they come back and kind of put another twist on it where Eddie does still use it in the end, which I thought was cool too. Just a lot of cool little details thrown in throughout this match to really make it interesting. Good performance by both guys, especially Eddie. I thought it was a top tier performance, and I continue. I mean, no shock, he's great, but the more and more I go through this run, and you could kind of, I feel like you could see his confidence building since that return early in the year when I first started the pod. You could definitely start, especially as they get into the SmackDown run with the SmackDown 6. I feel like you could really see Eddie starting to feel himself both in the ring and on the mic. And I'm really looking forward to seeing this run over the next, really the next couple of years.
Yeah, he's had a banger match every time I've been on this. Like, you know, he had the one with the tag match with Rock, him and Benoit, that against Edge and Rock, which I thought was really good. And then he had the ladder match against RVD, which I thought was just amazing. So, and he's just so vicious, like with his kicks, like it's just like the little things. It's just amazing.
Yeah, great intensity, great everything. So. But good start for SmackDown on their first match on the card. So, all right. So we head backstage. We see Triple H. He says he confronts RVD in the locker room and says RVD is calm, which means he doesn't care. And that's why he's never going to become champ. He then goes after Flair, who's also cleaning up after his match. He tells Flair Flair used to have it, but he has nothing now. And it says it makes sense that he would be getting ready next to Flair because he's going to end up just like Flair, washed up.
And a loser.
Yes, a loser. So he's basically shitting on both guys right here. And so we'll see how this comes out because he just said Rob is calm, which means he doesn't care about winning the title. He'll never become champ. And then Rob closes out by saying he'd rather associate with Ric Flair any day compared to Triple H. So
yeah, it's pretty corny what RVD said. Not going to lie.
Yeah, this wasn't his best because his stuff throughout this feud at times is a bit corny, but like in a interesting way or in a fun way. And this kind of just came off as just straight corny. It wasn't as, I agree with you, it wasn't as good as the stuff he cut in the promo on Raw against Triple H. So yeah, he's just like, well, I'd rather be with him than you because you're a jerk kind of thing. It felt very, I don't know, after school specialish to me.
But yes.
All right, but we'll see more of them in just a second. But before that, we will get our big brand rivalry tag team match to see if Eric Bischoff will have to kiss Stephanie's ass or if Stephanie will have to participate in HLA. So we have Billy and Chuck versus Rosie and Jamal, a.k.a. 3-Minute Warning. Rico makes himself known really early in the match by hitting Billy with a kick on the apron. Pretty good power offense. And from Rosie and Jamal, we have a back suplex. They have some heavy strikes. Rosie taunts Chuck, pulling his hand towards Billy to kind of mock him because he can't go for the tag. But then he ends up missing a moonsault, which gets Billy and Chuck some momentum. Billy gets some offense in, but is he goes for a noggin knocker on Rosie and Jamal, which is not effective, and they just whip his ass after. Chuck is able to hit a super kick, but Jamal hits him with one. Everything's starting to break down at this point. Billy runs in, hits a famous one on Jamal, but Rico is able to delay the pin long enough to save them. We get a Rosie hit him with the Samoan drop, Billy, and that is what ends our match here. So Billy gets pinned by the Samoan drop. Let me ask you something, Scott. So obviously now HLA is apparently going to be coming at us later in the show, as Stephanie will now have to participate in HLA, we're told. But anyway, what did you think of, because I feel like that was really, besides the stipulation, this match was really all about the debut of Rosie and Jamal as, like, in an actual match, not just beating people down. So what did you think of them in this first performance, Scott?
First off, for guys that size, they can move amazing. And I know, like, you know, people will say, oh, it's the Samoan blood, but God damn, if they weren't just, like, smooth in the ring. I never realized that, but, like, you know, they have, like, you know, like you said, the Samoan headbutt, but also Jamal hit that moonsault. If he would have landed on Chuck, he would have killed him right there in the ring. But it's just, like, for a big guy to be able to do that, you just don't see that. And I know Rosie and Roman are brothers, but damn, Jake, like, it's like they could have been twins, not even brothers. Like, they just mm-hmm. look so similar. And I will say for the ending, it was the midair counter of the Famouser, and it went to a Samoan drop. That just looked amazing. Like, holy shit. I wish, like, I don't want to get ahead, but I think 3-minute warning just, like, peters out. Like, I don't really remember what happens to him, but damn, like, you could have put the tag belts on them and just have them run through the tag division. But yeah, it was a nice coming out party for them. I am shocked, though, that Billy and Chuck lost, because they seem to be, like, getting a little bit of a push as, like, Stephanie's henchmen. Like, I know just with this feud, but, you know, they were getting a little bit of the rub from that, and they got all the publicity about, you know, their ceremony that, you know, didn't happen. But it just seemed weird for them. But somebody had to eat the pin here. So I think it was right with Billy and Chuck, but I went 2.5 for this, actually.
Yeah, I went 2. I feel like they, and it may be just my expectations, and I think it's probably an effect of seeing them do all the beatdowns where they look super impressive because they just come in and hit, like, a few really awesome moves and then get out, where I find they didn't look quite as impressive in this match. And maybe it's just because they just can't be hitting that stuff constantly. They hit some stuff, but I feel like they didn't. I guess I thought they might have looked more dominant or more impressive than they did. Not that the, how do I say it? Like, they did look impressive, but I guess I thought they would have been more dominant in this match. And I know you can't just have them come in and squash Billy and Chuck, even though I kind of feel like that's what you would want to do, you know, like, because Billy and Chuck, I mean, they are like Stephanie's, but I have a feeling they're not going to do jack shit after this. Like, they just kind of pawn them off for this angle, and then they're just going to let them flounder. I don't really remember, but we'll see how it plays out. But I almost wish that Rosie and Jamal would have just came out and crushed them. I thought it would have been more impressive, but not that they didn't. I thought they looked pretty good. And yeah, it was a fine enough match for what it was. It was just to kind of get Rosie and Jamal to show them in ring and kind of establish them and to get to our stipulation that we're going to be waiting for later in the night. So Eric is thrilled, of course. He's backstage with all his ladies, his hired talent, I guess, his lesbians, as he calls them. And he asked them, who wants Stephanie, and they all raise their hand. They all want Stephanie later for like a pack of hyenas. Like, they all want the fresh meat Stephanie. So bizarre. But they're all excited. So we'll see how this is going to play out later in the show. All right, so now we go to kind of – so this is the first thing where I was like, this is a weird place to have this in the show. So we get the RVD Triple H video package. I won't go through all of it. I've covered it as the weeks – in the previous weeks, just recapping everything that's led us up to this moment in their tag match. Any thoughts, Scott, since you weren't on all those shows, any thoughts on this feud overall?
I mean, when I was 13, I loved it. Because I was like, oh, RVD's going to get the title. I was convinced, like, Triple H was going to lose. Which, spoiler alert, Jake, I was convinced Triple H was going to lose a lot in the next, like, 4 years. sorry, Scott. But, you know, looking back, they should have pulled the trigger on RVD as champion the year before during the invasion, but obviously didn't. But, you know, I always thought RVD was a main eventer, so I'm glad that he was pushed up there. And, you know, I did say he was corny before, but him doing, like, you know, the water spot, it did make me laugh. He didn't feel out of place. Like, sometimes you see, like, you feel that people are out of place when they're feuding for the world title. It felt like, you know, naturally where he was supposed to be. So I was perfectly okay with it. I like the video package that set it up. Like, I will never say anything bad about WWE's video packages. They are top notch. But, yeah, just when you see this match pointed right here where it's at in the card, you're like, RVD's not getting the title.
Yeah, it kind of is a big red flag. Like, there's no way he's winning this an hour into the show. Like, what would it be like? RVD's, like, big crowning moment, and then we're just going to have the rest of the show after. Then we're going to have HLA after. Like, it would be, like, so, you know, so just immediately let you know, like, oh, no, there's no, he has no chance. So, I know, like, you want to finish with the Brock stuff because, I mean, for what they're doing, it makes more sense. It's the bigger match. We're going to find out this. This is sort of just a throwaway feud. But, yeah, it's immediately when they're coming out at this point in the show with this, you're kind of like, uh-oh. But you're like, oh, well, we might at least get a good match out of it. So we'll see. Quick little tangent about, it's funny you said this earlier. Like, you're saying, well, I thought RVD was going to win. Well, because a lot of the build to it, traditionally, in wrestling would be the kind of things you would do to that would happen to a face when they are going to win, because you like beat them down before their big win. But we'll see if that happens. But anyway, I was just thinking, you said like when you were 13, like I kind of like, I'm sort of happy that we grew up when we did, because can you imagine like a 13-year-old kid now? And like, if you wanted to, you could just like make a YouTube video after every pay-per-view that like would go out to everyone.
I would have been famous in the wrong ways, Jake.
Yeah, you know, like, imagine if all your, like, 12-year-old thoughts after every wrestling show were just, like, saved and put on the internet. Like, I kind of wonder about kids like that. Like, I'm glad technology was just, you know, behind my childhood. Because now, like, you know, if I was 12, I could go on YouTube and say it. Be like, I hate whoever. Like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
we like, dodged a bullet, Scott.
Oh, we dodged a major bullet because, like, Facebook, like, really, like, MySpace and Facebook hit when I was like a junior and senior in high school, and like I was posting some dumb shit to about 21, 22, just because it was in college and not everyone and their mother was on Facebook. But like I see some of the stuff that gets put up now and it's like we dodged a major bullet, because that shit will like come back and like, you know, haunt you for the rest of your life. And like I wasn't even saying anything bad, but it's just like cringeworthy, like an RVD promo.
Yeah 11-year-olds shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't have everything they say videoed and etched in stone and saved in cyberspace. But anyway, it just had me thinking when you said that about being, you know, when you, if you thought this was 13, I could just see your like video blog the night of the, like, right after the show going up. But anyway, so we head to the match now. I can see. So as they're doing the entrances, JR calls Triple H a mix of Harley Race and Jack Briscoe. And I could just see like so many old school, like NWA, like wrestling fans just
dying. Oh my inside. God.
Just yeah, like vomiting, like becoming physically ill at the thought of Triple H being a mix of Jack Briscoe and Harley Race. So
I will say, like, sorry to cut you off. I will say seeing Triple H with like a clean shaven face is somewhat strange, because I think he's had like, you know, the goatee or like the beard thing since like 2005, 2006. So going back almost 20 years and seeing it, it's like, oh yeah, we got mega douche heel Triple H here. Which I'm happy that you're going back and like revisiting all this, because like I remember being on like message boards and stuff back then and the calling this like the Reign of Terror. So like I want to see like if it's still like that bad, or we were just blowing it up just because there was nothing else to watch with wrestling, which I know is what you talked about at the start of the pod, but I just wanted to reiterate that.
Oh, absolutely. It's a big, I think it's a big story to watch throughout as I continue on the pod, no doubt. But anyway, we talked about it. It really does not seem like RVD is going to win this mid-show, but we'll see. So the early going, we do some feeling out. Rob's kind of messing with Triple H because everything, he's trying to kind of put some wrist locks and stuff on him, and everything he does, RVD just kind of finds a way to twist out of it, which sort of frustrates him. RVD hits a headlock, and Triple H is able to get out of that and bails out of the ring for the first time in the match. Won't be the last. Rob mocks him. So this was such a strange spot here. So they come back in. Somebody throws Rob a water bottle, and he does the full-on, like, water spitting routine as Triple H just, like, sneers at him. That was such a weird spot to me in that it didn't seem like a WWE spot. This felt like something you'd see on, like, you know, I'm not like an expert on PWG and all, but it felt like a very indie spot. Not saying that in a bad way. It just felt out of place in WWE. Like, I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do. It just felt odd in this place to have them do that. It felt very indie to me. I don't know.
Yeah, it did. But I also enjoyed it because, like, I knew RVD was losing, obviously, by the match thing. And it felt like, you know, he was just like, I may be losing, but I'm going to make you look like a fucking moron while I'm doing it. So...
Yeah, you know. I think I enjoyed it too. It just felt, it just doesn't seem like something they typically do. It just kind of caught me off guard. But anyway, continue with the match. RVD counters some. Triple H comes at it with the clubbing blows. He counters out with some reversals and twists back into the headlock. So continue to use his agility to kind of frustrate Triple H. So Triple H bails again to the outside after a kick out. He goes after him, goes for a senton to the outside, and just completely eats it as Triple H moves. That was a sick bump. He landed right on his tailbone.
I screamed, oh my God, when that happened, because it was a solid thud that hit. And, like, what the hell's going through his head with that? Like, he's probably still feeling that spot to this day.
It was brutal. It was a sick bump. He just landed, like, flush on his lower back. It was bad. But anyway, so the ref starts to count. Rob barely makes it back in before the 10 count. There's a little bit of controversy even on commentary. I think King says questions whether he even made it back. But anyway, we go back in, and then we start with the normal, we'll call it the methodical Triple H offense. Triple H throws him into the steps, punches him on the mat. He does the middle rope guillotine spot. Not a ton of urgency, I would say, is a way that you could describe this offense here. He throws Rob out of the ring again. He tries to throw him on the announce table, but RVD blocks it and hits Hunter on the table instead. They work their way back in. Triple H goes to the top and gets hit with the JR even calls it, saying that's not something you usually see from Triple H, and he ends up taking the flare bump, the famous flare bump off the top rope. We then go into Rob actually goes into a sleeper hold. And I felt like at this point in the match, this is where it was really starting to drag. Like, because this is, I want to say we're probably about a little over halfway through the match here, Scott. And I felt like they just could not get out of first gear. I don't know if it was just the Triple H offensive sequence, but it just felt like they were kind of stuck.
Yeah, I actually have here in my notes, Triple H now dominating, yawn. Triple H sleeper hold on RVD. Somehow it's working on me too. I don't know if he was like trying to be like, you know, I've never seen a Jack Briscoe. I've only seen a couple Harley Race matches, like that slow and methodical style, which does not work in 2002 WWE, considering the fast paced match we just saw with Edge and Eddie. And even the Samoan match, the 3 minute warning match, it just felt like you said, like they couldn't get out of first gear. And then with what we're going to have coming up, it's just like, I don't know what the hell they were doing with this match.
Yeah. You didn't feel a lot of urgency or like intensity for a big title match, you know, especially one where they've kind of been going at each other on TV. So there's a little bit of heat to this feud and they made it kind of personal. I mean, he's telling RVD that he's not, you know, he's not good enough to be champion and all this kind of stuff. So it's a pretty heated feud, but the intensity is just not coming through in the match. But We'll see if they can in the second part. But definitely, those are my thoughts as I got about halfway. I was like, this is starting to drag. I'm starting to feel drag a little bit. I feel like you did the feeling out a little bit. We need to start picking this up the intensity at some point in this match. But anyway, Rob is able to push out of the sleeper hold and hits a heel kick. And he starts going into his normal sort of RVD maneuvers. He does a step over. He hits a drop kick. He does a handspring moonsault, the monkey flip. And it's odd because, and this is what I was thinking too, is I don't know what has preceded this, because now Rob's kind of hitting this stuff, but it's not really getting much from the crowd. And I don't know maybe if the crowd, like it was the lackluster heat segment by Triple H that kind of took them out of a little bit. But normally the crowd like eats it up whenever RVD goes into his, you know, his educated feet, you know, his normal. These are like, you know, these are his key spots that the crowd usually loves. But I don't know if it's just everything they had done up to this point kind of killed him. I know a lot of people, and I'd probably agree. I think it was that Triple H kind of slow heat segment that just kind of, like, by the time they get to this, the crowd's already kind of, they've lost the crowd a bit by the time they got to this, you know, RVD firing up on him.
Yeah, I was lost myself. I mean, I will say RVD, like, you know, getting on his run got me back into it. But then it was sort of like, I'm looking at my watch, like, is this match almost over? I got to go back to work. So I watch these on my lunch break. So it's just like, this match is like, you know, making me lose the will to live. And, you know, I like both performers, but it's just like their chemistry was not there tonight.
So as we get to the final stretch, after RVD hits all of his stuff, Triple H bails out again, but Rob comes right back at him with a suicide dive. He does the top rope sidekick back in the ring. He hits a knee to the, but Triple H cuts him off with his patented knee to the face, like face buster move. Then the ref gets bumped. RVD is then able to catapult Triple H. He goes for the frog splash, but we have no ref. Rob's trying to get the ref back to it. He gets hit with a low blow by Triple H. Triple H goes to the outside. He grabs a sledgehammer, but Rob is able to kick it out of his hands, which the crowd really kind of starts to come alive at this point, at least. Then we see Flair run in. He goes in and grabs it. You think possibly he's going to hit RVD. But I mean, Florian Slip. You think he's going to hit Triple H, but he actually hits RVD, which seems to surprise Triple H. So this... they sell it as if this was not a premeditated, or I should say that Flair and Triple H hadn't planned this out before, that Flair has made this decision, because Triple H looks a little bit shocked here, but he just goes along with it, hits the pedigree, they revive the ref, 1, 2, 3, and that is it. So we've kind of spoke about it as we've kind of broke it down as we went, but I don't know, kind of boring and meandering, never really escalated, like we said, never really got out of first gear. It felt like a lot of what they were doing was just killing time to get to the Flair stuff. So I went 2.5, and there's some other parts to this we'll talk about in a second, because I didn't think it was – I went 2.5, which part of me thinks I might be overrating it a bit, but I do think there was some good stuff in here at certain points. It's just the flow and pacing of it just never really clicked for me. Where were you at with it, Scott?
I went 2.25, just like that, you know, you know, I'm starting to fall asleep watching wrestling. That's never good. Because, you know, wrestling's supposed to be, like, in your face, loud. You know, how the hell are you supposed to fall asleep during it? But I was, like, laying on my couch, like, playing on my phone. And I was like, damn, this match is pretty boring. I'm not a big fan of, like, oh, they got the visual pin. He would have won if the ref wasn't here. That's still not winning a match. Like, that's not going to make RVD, quote-unquote, a main eventer. Like, no. You know, and he got two visual pins. It's like, well, that doesn't mean jack shit. No.
Even King makes a good point. It's one that I always think when they do the visual pin thing. Because King even points out, he's like, well, why would he kick out? He knows there's no ref. Who would he be kicking out for? Like, it's a good point, actually.
And, you know, Flair coming down and turning, like, I figured it was coming. I don't know what I would have thought at 13, but, like, you know, they don't... I do, like, sort of like the story they told with that, with, like, Triple H has been beating him down for weeks, saying he's not a man, you know, he's a loser, and, you know, now Flair's like, I'll show you a loser, and instead of hitting Triple H, hits RVD, so he could, like, you know, relive his golden years with Triple H being, like, the new Flair, quote-unquote, so it's interesting to see if they continue going with that, but the middle part, I even have a note here, middle part killed me, so...
Yeah, you know what doesn't help it either is, like, we just watched that Eddie and Edge match where the issue with this one is that it never, like, escalated. It felt they were just kind of meandering around. And we just watched the Edge and Eddie match where everything in it felt so deliberate. Like, everything Eddie did felt like it had a real purpose to it. Like, he had a strategy. It had a really awesome intensity. You really felt like they were trying to go at each other. And then you get to this, and it just feels like meandering. There's no urgency to anything. We just kind of fuck around for a little bit, and then Flair, we get a ref bump. You know, kind of ref bump, sledgehammer, Flair turn. There you go. And then the thing is, so you have RVD losing after you spent this whole thing. He lost to Jericho. You've been spending the whole. And this is where you start getting into, you know, where people criticize Triple H, because you have this whole feud where the whole thing is him saying that RVD is not good enough. Like, he's not worthy of being champion. He's not good enough to be champion. And then he comes in. I mean, he's not really beating him clean, but he comes in. He beats him. And it's like, well, maybe he wasn't. You know, it doesn't really, like you said, the visual pin doesn't help. It's pretty much like he comes in, he crushes Rob, and that's pretty much it. Because you don't really get any kind of feeling that the feud's going to continue. If anything, RVD might feud with Flair would be what you would think at this point. So it's like, you know, it's a thing Aaron always says, Aaron George says. He says a lot on, you know, the year that was, is that, you know, is Triple H helping anybody? And I think it'd be hard to say that RVD is helped by this feud in any way.
No, he's played like a chump. He's said, like, he doesn't deserve the title. He's a loser because he's calm, cool, and collected. And what happens at the end of this? He's a loser. And next month they go on another feud. So it's like, yeah, here's one of your biggest faces on Raw. Which, you know, if you're going against Triple H, you're the biggest face at the moment, because Raw's not really hitting on a lot of faces. I would say RVD, Booker T, he's working his way up, and Kane are the three biggest faces, and you just made the biggest face look like a piece of shit.
Yeah, and so this is what I was saying earlier. And so the backstage rumors are that, you know, that the scuttle backstage is that Triple H was trying to expose Rob, and he had kind of spoken out against him in meetings saying he wasn't over enough. He's not a guy that they should get behind. I don't know, you know, that's like any backstage rumor. Is there truth to it? And that it sort of like that Triple H wanted to put this match together because it was worked in a way that kind of tones down RVD's style. It's not really worked in a style that's going to make RVD look great and put on a great match that RVD can, because this is not, you know, this match was not set up in a way that really plays to RVD's strengths. And so, you know, some believe that that was done purposely to kind of make him look like shit. Is any of that true? I don't really know. There's no way for me to really know, but it's just another facet to this whole deal.
Yeah. I had never heard that before, and, you know, if so, then he did a good job of killing him off, because he wouldn't be viable again for another, 4 years?
Yep. So, all right, so we're already starting to see maybe this is the reign of terror. So this is, you know, not the best look for Triple H so far. Not a good match, not making his opponent look very good, so... but anyway, we'll continue on. We've talked about that quite a bit. Anyway, Flair shakes his hand, so seemingly has an alliance with Flair moving forward. All right, we now head backstage to one of the most random backstage segments you're ever going to see. We have D'Lo Brown. Even before the third shows up, this is already pretty, like, out of nowhere. We have D'Lo discusses the match that they just watched with Kidman. They both have on, like, generic Unforgiven 2002 t-shirts. So they just, like two random dudes who, like, have the night off. They're just, like, hanging out backstage collecting a paycheck. And then, I don't even know the guy's name. You might know Scott. I just call him Victor Newman. So it's Victor Newman from Young and the Restless comes in. He shakes their hands. D'Lo says he wants to know wants to know him if he could get someone to side, because he knows he's always getting all the women because he's on Young and the Restless. Newman says he cannot discuss those matters. And then Dawn Marie shows up and seems to suggest that she is definitely banging Victor Newman, and that she is about to go and bang Victor Newman. So who would have ever thought that D'Lo, Kidman, and Victor Newman Are you familiar with Victor Newman, Scott?
No, I thought that when I messaged you and I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And you're like, Victor Newman. I thought that was just his name. I didn't realize that might be his name in the show. I'm glad that D'Lo's not in Japan wrestling. So it's a Highway to Impact Zone joke. But
You mean like you don't want him to be in Japan dominating everybody?
Yeah, dominating everyone, yeah. And, you know, he hasn't had his kid yet, so he can't go lead to take care
of
her.
His own reign, D'Lo's reign of terror in Japan. Like Triple H's reign of terror.
Dom Marie's looking great. Like, looking damn good. But such a just random mismatch. They're like, maybe they saw D'Lo and Billy at catering and was like, hey, assholes, come in over and do this. It was very odd. And, like, the guy didn't even get a pop when he showed up on the screen. Everyone else was like, who the hell is this?
Yeah, well, the problem is that it wasn't my grandmother in the audience at Unforgiven 2002, because that's how I know Victor Newman is, from being at my grandma's house. She would watch Young and the Restless religiously. She actually called my mom in the afternoon sometimes to discuss the happenings on Young and the Restless, as if they were like real people. She like, did you see what Victor did today? Because he was kind of like a villainous sort of guy, if I remember Victor Newman correctly. He kind of scared me as a kid, because he kind of looks like a vampire to me.
Well, he definitely has like the mob hair. Like, he could have been like an extra in The Sopranos to me.
And yeah, he talks like, you heard him even in this part. He talks in his voice like this, very kind of menacing and low. So that kind of freaked me out as a kid too.
So great.
So of all the celebrities, they're in LA. So obviously they must have just found this guy because they're in LA. Who knows? I don't know what the backstory is, but you would think of all the people they're in LA, you couldn't have got somebody maybe more relevant that wrestling fans would have maybe known than.
Wait, this guy's still freaking, on the show.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure he is. He's been on there forever. He's a vampire. He's not going to die. Okay. Anyway. But anyway, but yeah, you would think, they should have got Vin Diesel. They're doing all this Triple X crossover.
And then having with The Rock before, you know, they had their issues on Fast and Furious 9.
Of course, good tie in 20 years, 20 years before. Anyway, all right, we'll move on. So our next match is kind of out of nowhere. It's a match that I've been wanting to see. But the problem now is that they really have not focused on it in a long time in any real direct way. And that's going to be Molly versus Trish for the women's title, because they were feuding for a while. And then it kind of their feud devolved into sort of just being thrown into mixed tag matches, where really the story was not much about them directly. It was a lot about Chris Nowinski wanting to take Molly's virginity and all this nonsense. So, and this has not really gotten any kind of direct build in the past month of TV. Like, you still have the lingering heat between them, but I don't know. This whole feud could have been so much better if they would have just focused on it and got to this point. But now it just kind of seems, you know, it just seems a little forgotten. Like, it just random, like, oh, yeah, now we're finally going to have the big blow-off that we haven't given a shit about in, like, a month and a half. Now, here you go. Here's the big blow-off.
Yeah, it seemed like this pay-per-view was going real well till the last match, and now it just putters along for the next, I'll say, about 45 minutes. And this is, I know you're going to get to it, Jake, but this is not a good match. But I will say, King says that Molly has a home in the Virgin Islands, which I thought was a pretty funny line.
Oh, my God. Fucking kidding. You know, I will say, I didn't think this was a great match, but I did think there's a good performance for Molly. I thought Molly was really good in this match. Like after they do some feeling out, I like all the urgency to her offense. I mean, look, I'm not trying to grab, but you probably have more urgency to her offense in this than Triple H had in that match. Like, she's kind of snapping off everything, like her suplexes and stuff. Like, it has a nice crispness to everything she's doing. Like you mentioned, King makes that stupid joke about her being from the Virgin Islands. Trish tries to get back in it with some flash pins. That doesn't really work. She has to chick kick out of nowhere, and then ends up getting hit by Molly again. Molly blocks I thought this was a really cool spot here where Trish goes to do that normal where she goes up and does kind of like a kind of like a Hurricane Rana, where she catches the person's head with her feet and throws them off. But Molly kind of she reversed that and turned it almost into like a tarantula looking submission hold in the corner that I thought looked pretty cool. That was really awesome. That was probably the spot of the match to me. But then Trish hits reverses. I forget what Molly was trying to do, but Trish reverses it and hits a bulldog out of nowhere and ends up winning. So I thought Molly looked really awesome in this match. Her stuff looked great. But it was weird. It was kind of one of those matches where the face just get their ass kicked the entire match and then it's one big move in the end and wins, which to me is not the greatest. You know, it's a little, it kind of hurts the match a little bit because all that awesome stuff that Molly did just kind of gets, you know, Trish hits one big move and I kind of get it. It's out of nowhere or whatever. But I kind of wish that Trish would have had to work a little bit harder throughout the match to get it. But I actually thought this was okay. I went 2.25 on it. I thought it was fine. I thought Molly particularly looked really awesome in this match.
Damn, this is where we differ, Jake, because we've been pretty much aligned the whole night. I did not enjoy this match at all. Like,
yeah,
I thought it was slow and plodding. I even have a note here that says, just let it end. Like, it's like you said, Molly did take like 95% of the match and Trish just did the 5%. But it definitely felt like, which sadly, that's what the women division was at this time, was just a piss break match. I went 1 star on it.
See, I think maybe you were put in a foul mood after watching that that title match, maybe. Maybe you're feeling a little salty after the title match. Maybe that it hurt this match a little bit. Like, I didn't think it was any great shakes, but I'm pretty much most of my 2.25 goes to Molly. Because I don't know, I thought she looked good in this match. I think with more focus and build to this, it could have been a lot better. Because it kind of, I think you have them, you know, not really doing much with this feud for a while. And then coming off of that that last match that kind of killed the crowd a little bit, I think they were in a tough spot. But
And I think because, like, I felt for you because, and even since I've been, like, with my guest appearances, like, it feels like they had a match together for, like, 3 months straight. If it was, like, a mixed tag or something. And I was just like, I'm tired of seeing these two people go against each other.
No. Yeah, and that hurts it, too. Like I said, they've done them no favors with the build to it by just being so wishy-washy with it. But anyway, Trish is emotional after the win. She gets the title now. And we'll see where it goes from here. All right, we then head backstage. We see Rosie and Jamal enjoying their win with Eric Bischoff's ladies. Rico asks if he and the ladies could go on their way. And so kind of implying that Rico is going to go have some fun times with these ladies, which the way they portrayed him, doesn't seem like he'd be interested, but who knows. But anyway, Eric then says he needs two to stay behind for HLA. And so we get our two ladies who are going to stay behind for HLA.
And Jake, in my opinion, he pulled the two hottest.
Yeah, most likely. Yeah. I think I didn't get to survey it that good, but it seems like a Bischoff thing to do.
Yes.
Or a Vince thing to do. Anyway, we now head to our next match, which is going to be Angle versus Chris Benoit, which I've talked about it in the build, but the whole feud is built around each one of them being pissed off that the other one put them in position to get the stink face and laughed at each other, which sounds silly as shit, but it actually is a pretty good build to the feud. Like, I don't know. It was well done. It actually it's worked out pretty well. I think it built well to this match. But anyway, we go in. You know that you're going to get some nice intensity from these two guys. They get an intense lockup to start, and they go out of the ring pretty quickly. Benoit locks in a short-lived crossface really early in the match. And a lot of this early part is them really work on the mat, like scrapping around the match, which I thought was in and had some nice energy to it. It wasn't just like them kind of feeling out slowly. It was still like, it was really, I don't know how to say this, like they're really aggressive about it. Like, and I kind of liked both guys going for the finish from the start. Like Benoit goes for the crossface, Angle goes for the ankle lock within the first few minutes of the match. We get they go for a furious sequence of pin reversals that I thought was really well done. Like, I want to say they did at least like 10 different reversals, different types of pins, which is really cool. And I kind of like this whole opening segment. It was a nice change of pace that they didn't immediately go for hitting these like big moves, like all these big high spots. It was just a lot of them scrapping around, reversing pins, trying to get a little bit of momentum on the other one, lock in some kind of hold, And I don't know, it just looked really, it looked really well done. I don't know. And it, I mean, a lot of this, I'm sure, is Angle, because obviously Angle's an amateur wrestler. He knows how to make this stuff look good and look believable. And I thought it did. But I kind of liked that this first part, considering what's to follow in a minute, they didn't come straight out of the gate with the hashtag moves, as we call it sometimes.
No, it was great. And to be completely honest, Jake, I got lost in this match. Like, I was... Mm-hmm. Just like my notes are sparse. Like, I have some notes, but we haven't gotten to them yet. But like, damn, like I do my best to like try to stay away from the Benoit matches because of what happened. But like, obviously, if I'm doing a rewatch, I have to watch them. It's just the name of the game. Mm-hmm. But holy shit. Like, I know we messaged about this, but Benoit has to be one of Angle's best opponents, right? Like, because their chemistry is just off the charts.
Yeah, because I think it's – Angle is so intense, and I think it's – like, Benoit was a guy who can, like match that intensity. And even from the get-go, like I said, even though they're not hitting any real big moves, they're just kind of sort of chain wrestling, I guess you could call it, on the mat for a little while. Right from the jump, you really get a sense that these two guys are trying to go after each other and, like – prove that they're better than the other one. And just the way they move and just the level of how tight everything is that they're doing, they really look like they're trying to win, and they're trying to show that they're better than the other guy. Like, it's like the opposite of what I said with the RVD Triple H match, where they couldn't get the intensity going. These guys, it's like from the moment the bell rings, you just feel the intensity from both of them, and it just adds to the match. But anyway, going to the
That RVD match, they couldn't get out of first gear. It's like they started this match in fourth gear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but without having to go for, like, just going straight to the big moves. It's just their energy. It's awesome. But anyway, so Angle, by this point, has kind of had enough of all this work on the mat and stuff, and he just throws Benoit out the ring and just goes after with some strikes. So I like that, too. I like that it fits Angle's character, too, that he would get frustrated. He's tired of this shit. He's just going to go after him. He locks him. They go back in the ring, and Angle locks him down in kind of like a body hold. I'm not the greatest guy at calling holds. I don't know exactly what it was, but he kind of just had him like grapevined on the bottom.
Yeah.
But Benoit kind of attacks his legs to be able to escape. Kurt crashes into the post, and Benoit throws him back into the other one, which I thought was a really awesome spot, too. They both catch their breath for a minute and trade rolling Germans in a great sequence. They do a lot of back and forth, like, anything you can do, I could do better sort of stuff in this match. So, like, Benoit hits the rolling German, so Kurt reverses it and gets his own little sequence of them. And then I love how it sort of ends it kind of crescendos with him going for an Angle slam, but then it gets reversed. Benoit reverses it, and he does sort of a release German, and Angle just fucking flips. Like,
dude, that was disgusting. It was amazing.
He launched him. So it kind of ends that whole sequence. It was really awesome. And then Benoit goes to go up the top. Angle does his normal where he sprints up to the top rope and hits the belly to belly, which looked awesome. He goes for the ankle lock, but Benoit kicks it away. I love the way that they break all the holes in here. They found, like, little cool creative ways to break everything. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, he rolled out of it. Like, you can see him kick Kurt in the hand to get out of it. Like, everything in the match felt like a struggle, and I always loved that matches of this style, where everything every guy's doing just looks like they're struggling. Like, when somebody puts in a hole, the other guy's struggling, trying to get out any way he can. It's always awesome. But, we then, Benoit is able to get a shoulder breaker. He goes for the top rope headbutt, but as happens to him a lot of times, he's delayed in the pin because of the impact on his own body. And so that only gets a near fall because Kurt has enough time to recover. He goes for the cross face, but Angle is able to grab the leg while he's in the cross face and twist that into the ankle lock. Benoit reverses that back to the cross face, then back to the ankle lock. And then Angle actually gets the crossface in. And then Benoit kind of works into this weird cover attempt. I don't even know really what to call it. He puts his feet on the ropes, but he is able to get the pin on Angle. So a lot going on in this match, Scott. What did you think? I know you said, I think you're pretty high on it. You said you got lost in it. Yeah.
I'm going to catch shit for what I'm about to rate this match, but I'm here for it. Just them reversing the crossface to ankle lock, all that stuff was just like... The intensity is just fucking off the charts. And, like, you know, I only have, like, six notes here just because, like I said, I got lost in it and I was like, damn, this shit is really good, because like I knew who won the main events because I remember the title history, but with these matches I was like, I have no recollection, but just like just everything, like these guys just beat the hell out of each other, and like he's talked about with like the revert, like the release German suplex, like I thought Angle was dead, like he sold it amazing. Angle, you know, he, just one of the best to ever do it. I will say I didn't like the ending with him using the ropes, but both of them were technically heels going into this match. I'm in between 4.5 and 4.75 stars for this match, Jake. I'm somewhere in there. Like I think I'm gonna go 4.5 just because of the way he won by using the ropes.
No, I think that's actually so. I think I'm a little bit lower. I think where you're at is more what I've seen for people on this match. I went 4 on it, which again I think is kind of low. I still thought it was great. I thought it was awesome, but maybe a little bit lower. I didn't love the finish. I thought for everything they did in there, the pin attempt, the pinning combo that Benoit didn't look, for all the stuff that they did throughout this match, it wasn't the most impressive. Like I don't know, the ending felt a little flat for me. It wasn't just the feet on the ropes thing. It's just after all those pinning reverses they did earlier, I thought it just looked a little awkward the way they did it in the end. But yeah, it just came off of great intensity, just awesome technical struggle of a match. There was a nice mix of them doing kind of holds and mat work and then kind of putting in the big moves and, you know, all these big, you know, like the belly to belly off the top rope, the release German, like they were to put those in throughout the match in just the proper places to help this build to where, again, it was an awesome match. Just like we said with the Edge and Eddie match, it felt very back and forth, but it didn't ever feel like they were just trading moves. It felt very organic the way the momentum would shift back and forth as these two guys struggle with each other, which is awesome. And to your point, it's kind of what gets you invested in the match and kind of elevates it to where you can get sort of lost in it. But even though I'm a bit lower, still a great match. I went 4, you went 4.5. It's awesome. It's, you know, if it's considered a hidden gem, I guess you can call it a hidden gem, but I think this is a pretty well-known. I think it's sort of considered, I guess, sort of the prequel to the match that's widely gets the 5 stars at the Rumble.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't even realize, like, this was rated that highly. I was about to be like, oh, we found a hidden gem, but yeah. But yeah, it's, I just can't, I can gush over it. Angle is just ridiculous.
Now, I do think it is, for them, it is forgot, again, because of the Rumble match and just this show being kind of in a weird spot, a September show, and all the other stuff that happens on this show, I do think it is a little bit forgotten. I don't know if it's like one that people don't know about, but I think relative to some their other stuff or the other stuff on this show, I think it gets buried a little bit. I will say that.
Yeah, I definitely would have to agree with you on that one.
But awesome, awesome stuff. So SmackDown continuing to be on a roll as they have put on 2 really awesome matches with their undercard. But anyway, all right, we head backstage to see Brock getting an interview, getting ready for the main event. Heyman speaks for him, saying it has been personal. He's asked if this is personal, and Heyman says, the moment that you want to fight for the title and take the title away from Brock Lesnar, it becomes personal because that is what's important to Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman. Brock actually gets the mic at the end, adds that he has no remorse and no problem being unforgiven, which I thought was kind of a little corny. I don't know.
No, it was a lot corny, but I'm not going to tell that big bastard that. Yeah, Brock was great.
Yeah, he's still... See, I don't find his deliveries right. It's just, I don't know. Just, I feel like the few times they give him the mic, it's only to say like weird, awkward stuff. Like when he says, when he holds on to Taker's wife, it's like, life's a bitch. And then he says this thing. Like, it's so weird. Like, it would be like if it was Backlash. He's like, I hope Taker's ready to feel the backlash. It's just,
or he's going to feel no mercy.
But I did like Heyman. I thought Heyman's line was really awesome. I thought that was a good little twist when he says that it's personal. Anytime you go for the title, it becomes personal. I thought that was pretty cool. But all right. So we are ready for our big, I guess this will be like our semi-main event segment here, Scott. It's going to be Eric Bischoff strutting out with his quote-unquote lesbians. And he says, tonight, LA Norm does not stand for Los Angeles. It stands for lesbian action. So.
Yeah.
He says the two ladies' names are Peaches and Cream. Peaches and Cream, sorry. So, nice, scummy Bischoff in full, you know, slimy heel Bischoff mode here. We then see Stephanie head out, and Bischoff is, he's giddy, extremely giddy here. He says he wants what the French call a menage a trois, a three-way. The girls start to disrobe. They take off their shirts, and then they start to help. He tells them to help Stephanie with her jacket, and they start massaging her back as they take off her jacket. And Eric Bischoff says he's tired of all this. He wants it to get serious, and he starts leading the crowd in HLA chant. How, before we get to the what happens next, how are you feeling about this segment so far, Scott?
32-year-old Scott was like, why the fuck am I watching wrestling? And I'm probably, this is probably going to get me a lot in trouble here, but I sent this note to you, what I had written down. I had 13-year-old Scott, he probably would have had dick in hand right now, ready to see some HLA.
Another reason why we shouldn't have a podcast for 13, probably.
Exactly, because it would have been like, WWE, I'm unsubscribing from the network. They said HLA. I didn't get it. yeah, it was, it's something. Yeah.
Yeah, to watch these quote-unquote lesbians massaging Stephanie's back. But as the crowd is starting to get into it, Bischoff cuts them off, and he tells the lesbians that they're excused. So everyone's a little bit confused at this point. He says he wanted it to be the most humiliating experience of Stephanie's life, so he found the most repulsive lesbian he could. We then cut to the ramp, and we see the music here was killing me, Scott. Shift, the music was just like this ridiculous generic funk music. And then we see what we assume is a very large, a heavyset lady in a purple dress strutting down the ramp. And I think he said her name was her name Hildegard or Hildegrand, something like that?
Hildegrand.
Hildegrand. So he says this woman's name is Hildegrand. The crowd has just let them have it at this point. They're very disappointed. They wanted to see Stephanie McMahon kissing the two other ladies. So Bischoff has taken that away from them. Hildy starts to fondle herself as Eric Bischoff says that she's done some part-time in prison as well. She approaches, and to Eric Bischoff's surprise, when she approaches Stephanie, they actually share a very passionate kiss, which has Eric a little bit thrown off. But all of a sudden, about 5 to 10 seconds into this very passionate makeout session between Hildy and Stephanie, Hildy hits out of nowhere, hits Bischoff with a sidekick, rips her makeup off, and reveals that she is actually Rikishi. So Stephanie beat him at his own game with the prosthetics here.
JR has a great line here where he says, world's biggest lesbian, talking about Rikishi. So it's like, Jesus Christ.
And so when he releases the kiss and does all this, it's a great image too, because Stephanie has all of her, all of Hildegrand / Rikishi's very thick red lipstick all over her face. And so then Rikishi, of course, proceeds to beat down Bischoff, give him the stink face. And Stephanie actually... So cracks. he has like these like a negligee on, and Stephanie like helps him pull it up his ass to further expose his cheeks. So that's a fun. I have to turn that into a GIF or a GIF or whatever. Just the image of Stephanie like hiking up his underwear up his ass crack.
It was definitely something. I had remember reading about this on WrestleCrap.com back in the day. But actually seeing it, and it was just like, how the hell was this on TV?
And so they give Bischoff an extended stink face, and then as he's reeling, they do the two cool dance. And Stephanie's even getting into it. She has a little bit of a line from Seinfeld energy going on with her dancing. but she's it was kind of fun to see her acting, you know, kind of being goofy. It reminded me, it had this energy of like, I felt like she was like at a bachelorette party and like she had made friends at the bar with this drag queen and now they were like drunk having a good time. That's the energy that this had. Like Stephanie is like, you know, went to Vegas or whatever with her girlfriends. They had a big party. They went to a drag show and she got drunk and made friends and now they're dancing around. And of course, Taz and Cole have a good laugh about all of this because SmackDown is victorious in all this. But I don't know. this is fine. I mean, I think Eric plays a good enough, like this to me reached the point of like wrestling ridiculous that I kind of like. Like when it gets so absurd like this, like Stephanie's pulling up his underwear to go further up his ass crack, and they have this like insane dance while Eric's like reeling in the corner. Like it just got to a level of absurdity that I'd like. If you're gonna do stuff like this, I need you to go full on ridiculous. And they did in this, so I was okay with it.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, hopefully we never hear the words HLA ever again. I think they made a t-shirt for it, but yeah, it's probably up there with that APA always pound an ass shirt of people not wanting to ever own.
Yeah, and so he's definitely going to get some heat with the fans by taking away their HLA. Like, kind of, you know, the fans were looking forward to it, and he just snatched it out of their grasp. They thought they were going to get to see Stephanie kiss on peaches and cream, but instead she made out with Rikishi.
Yeah, it's that's something they'll never do ever again. One and done.
All right. So coming off of that, we head to our big main event grudge match between Brock and Taker for the title. Of course, we get a big lengthy video package to recap everything that's happened. I won't go through all that, cover on the pod. Brock touched on Taker's pregnant wife's stomach, etc. That has sort of been the crux of the feud. And then also a big part of the feud is that this kind of started when Taker told Brock that, you know, he hasn't been tested yet, that he just became champion, but he hasn't really faced any sort of real test, which I think is important going into this match. Which I should say, the video package is set to the theme of Unforgiven 2002, which is Adrenaline by Gavin Rossdale, which I thought was kind of mediocre by butt rock standards.
It's some great 2002 butt rock.
But even though it's kind of watered down butt rock, it wasn't as in your... I would say it's the weakest butt rock track I've encountered through the podcast so far, because all these pay-per-views pretty much have butt rock as their themes. And this one I thought is a little too wispy for me. I need some in-your-face butt rock. Like, go full butt with it, you know?
Yeah, that's one thing I never understood was, like, how they were always had butt rock for, like, their pay-per-view stuff. I was like, come on, give me some rap or something, you know? I don't know how you could do country, but, you know, rap was pretty big around this time. I'm just shocked they never...
Well, here's the beauty of it. Here's the beauty of it, Scott, that sometimes the butt rock incorporates some elements of rap music into it. And that's when you really get a home run. And that's why Limp Bizkit is so synonymous with this era of WWE pay-per-view, because then you get the best of both worlds. You get the butt rock and the rap. So,
yes.
Anyway. But anyway, not the greatest butt rock ever. I put it low on the butt rock scale. Anyway, all right, we get into the match. We get some face-to-face posturing to start. Brock pushes Taker off when they lock up, kind of showing that maybe he has a strength advantage. Taker answers by rocking Brock out of the ring, which I have to say a lot throughout this entire match, Brock is bumping his ass off. He is like bumping like he's Mr. Perfect in there. Like when he gets knocked out of the ring, he like flies out of the ring. Really impressive for a big guy. I think some would question, you know, should he be doing that considering his monster persona? But I think it's fine. I think it makes his matches more dynamic. But anyway, we continue. Brock comes back. He puts Taker to headlock, but Taker comes right back at him and knocks him out of the ring again. This causes Brock to become frustrated. He throws the stairs in anger. He comes back in. We get a flying clothesline from Taker. And they're really trying to establish, and they mention this on commentary, that Taker has the experience, and that's why he's getting this early advantage. That's why Brock cannot get the upper hand on him. And they kind of make it seem like Brock is not used to getting frustrated like this because he's so dominant. So kind of going with the story, I guess you could say, of that he's never really been tested. Now Taker's starting to test him a little bit, so he's getting a little frustrated.
And I will say before you get ahead with the match, when Taker threw Brock out of the ring the first time, I've never seen someone go out of the ring with so much grace. Like no bullshit. Like, it was so smooth. Like, he went through the middle rope and landed on his feet. I was like, Jesus. Like, that, it was just absurd. Like, Brock was just amazing.
Yeah, he's so agile for being such a brick shithouse. Like, he's extreme. Like, he has great, like, his footwork and everything. Like, he's so I know he's agile. He's quick for such a big guy. I mean, again, got really some hot takes in this one. That Flair, good at the subtleties of wrestling. Brock's a freak athlete. Come here for all your hot takes. Anyway, we continue on. Heyman gets on the top on the apron and Taker hits him with a sick boot, and Heyman goes flying off the apron. I thought that was a good bump by Heyman. So it kind of neutralizes Heyman, at least for the time being. Brock takes advantage of that brief distraction, though, and shoulder blocks Taker in the corner. He then follows it up with a little bit of vertical suplex. And then he starts to work the midsection to try and take away Taker's win. He locks him in a bear hug, kind of grounded, a seated bear hug, I guess you could go, like he does sort of belly-to-back style. And then he comes back with a rolling belly-to-back suplex, which is really nice. And I like throughout this whole sequence, he never lets go. Like, no matter what, like, as he's going, he puts the bear hug, he does the belly to back, and Taz even mentions, like, he's not letting that thing go. And I love that. Like, that he was so relentless with it. I thought it was a nice touch. Like, he doesn't just, well, I hit my move, so I'm going to let go. No, he just keeps it until finally Taker's able to kind of swing out of it, uses momentum, and then Taker starts up with the soup bones, baby, starts hitting those Taker strikes. And like I said, some real Mr. Perfect selling, because on the last shot, Taker punches him and Brock like flies like halfway across the ring and flies out of the ring here. And then so Heyman recovers. He distracts the ref for just a second while Brock actually uses the belt, which busts Taker open. Brock goes back in. He starts working over the cut. But then Taker's not giving up. He fires back and does the I called it the choo-choo train in each corner. This little choo-choo train corner clothesline deal. He elbows out of Brock elbows out of the choke slam, but gets countered with a big boot. And again, I like the way that they've sort of gone with this whole idea of Brock being tested. It almost feels like Brock in the match felt that once he busted Taker over with the belt, it was going to be kind of academic, and he kind of had him at that point. So when Taker starts firing back at him and he realized the belt was not enough to put him away, like the belt shot and busting him open was not going to put him away, he starts to, you know, you kind of get the sense that he doesn't really know what to do at this point. So again, I kind of like how they're building that throughout the match, like kind of going with that whole thing of like, this might be Brock's biggest test to date. But,
yeah, like, mm-hmm. You'd seen, like, he had used his power to overwhelm everyone, and that's not really happening with Taker here. Like, you know, he used his power to, like, you know, literally beat down Hogan and make him leave the company. You know, he beat the hell out of Rock with his power. You know, they could have told the story that he was so scared of Austin that Austin walked out, and this is like you're seeing someone actually test him for once.
Yeah, and I know part of this with this match is, well, he's faced Rock, who's are like one of the biggest stars ever. He destroyed Hogan. Why is Taker taking it? But the thing is, like, you have to change it up. You can, so it's like, okay, so he's beat Rock, so now the rest of his run, he's just going to destroy everyone. Like, it wouldn't be very interesting. I at least think this is interesting. Now, do you normally think of as Rock as being maybe higher on the totem pole than Undertaker? Maybe, but I think for the story they're trying to tell, I think it's fine. But anyway, we continue. We get a ref bump at this point, as I think, I want to say it's Taker gets shoved into him. Taker hits the choke slam, but of course the ref is out, so we get no count. Then we get Matt Hardy running out of nowhere. He just gets the last ride, and immediately gets neutralized. He looks like a big chump, especially because he has like his jeans and his little like rayon flame shirt on. He just runs in the ring and immediately gets like destroyed.
Well, it's like a nice payoff because, like, you documented in the past 2 weeks, like, he's been, well, past couple of episodes, like, he's been delusional, like, saying he's a superstar, and, like, you know, he claims he has this win over Taker, but that's because of the whole Lesnar situation. So it was nice to see him come out and, like, you know, he did look like a picnic basket getting his ass whooped, but that was nice.
But he does allow Brock some time. He creates enough of a distraction, a decoy for Brock to recover a bit, hit a spine buster. The ref recovers by this point, but it's a near fall on the spine buster. And by this point, the crowd is really into this. The crowd is rocking at this point in the match. They built it well. The crowd's behind him. They're really behind Taker. Taker hits a desperation DDT at one point. Again, the crowd erupts for that. He goes for the tombstone, but the Brock reverses the tombstone, but the ref gets bumped again on that one. And I didn't mind. I know maybe one critique of this match is there's too many ref bunts, but I thought they did the ref bunts pretty well. And I think for this type of match and the way they built it is that you have these two huge guys. They're really going at it. It's getting really chaotic. To me, it kind of, in the way that they did them, where it's just kind of some guy getting shoved into them, to me, I didn't mind the ref bunts. They didn't seem very good. Like, they didn't just seem like it was in the Triple H match where it's like, well, we got to have the ref get bumped so we can do our shit. Like, you know, it kind of felt like there's these two, like, titans going at each other, and the ref is just getting in the way and getting cracked because these two guys are just getting to that point.
Yeah, but I just have a problem with the ref bumps because we've already seen it in the other quote-unquote main event match, and we already saw, like, visual pins. It's just like, really? You guys are supposed to be creative geniuses, and we're coming up with, like, and, you know, so many ref bumps, it felt like an ECW match to me, where it's like, ref bump, someone runs out, ref bump, chair slide in, ref bump three, like, and, yeah, and we'll get to it, but, yeah. It felt like I know Raw and SmackDown are supposed to be separate, but maybe Vince should have got everyone together and was like, hey, so we're not stealing each other's shit tonight. What's the plan? You know?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think it's, we'll get through the match and then we'll get through because we're not done, but that's a good point. But anyway, Taker, so Brock gets a chair, but Taker's able to stop it with a boot as Heyman is screaming and panicking at this point as he feels like things are really falling to pieces on him. Taker dents in the chair on Brock's head.
Disgusting. I think I saw the CTE right there.
Oh my goodness. It was brutal. The chair is legitimately dented in on Brock's head. So we get a bit of a lull here as after he hits him, Brock falls to the outside.
Killed him, Jake.
Yeah, so Brock is out on the outside. Taker's kind of just waiting around in the ring, but there's no count because the ref's down. And so finally, Taker starts to go back outside to throw him back in. We now see that Brock's bleeding, as you'd expect, after your skull got caved in with a steel chair. Taker goes for a lash ride, but Brock powers out of it and reverses into an F5. I'm sorry. He powers out of the lash ride. He goes for the F5, but Taker's able to reverse that. They go into the corner, and the ref gets caught in between them again and gets smashed, and he's had enough. He calls for the DQ to a huge boost from the crowd. The crowd is very disappointed by that finish, but that kind of ends it as we end on kind of a double DQ, as I guess what they're trying to portray is that the ref is tired of getting knocked around, so they throw it out. So that ends up being our finish, which I kind of have an idea what you're going to say, but what did you think of that as the finish, Scott? Are you with the Staples Center crowd?
Yeah, it's bullshit. It's straight up bullshit. Like, these guys had a hell of a match going. And, like, I know what they're eventually getting to next month, but fuck, like, you could have done it a different way. I would have been happier with, like, you know, even Hardy caught, like, being the reason for a DQ, and then, like, Taker whoops Hardy's ass 2 weeks from now on SmackDown or something. But this is just a bullshit cop-out finish. And keep in mind, people were spending, I'm pretty sure pay-per-views were $30 then, or were they $50 by that point?
I want to say we're still
$30. Either or, I would have been pissed. You spend $30 and, like, you get the bullshit ending with, like, not only the Y2J match with the Flair match, with the Flair grinding with the Triple H match, and then you get this. And the only match that delivered was, and quote unquote, if you're buying for the HLA, that didn't deliver either. So
you got blue balled on that one.
Yeah. So, and the only match that delivered was Benoit and Angle. So I would have been pissed. But, like, you know, I'm watching it on the cock for $10 a month because I can't do ads. So.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, so we end on that. So I'll talk about the post-match, and then we can kind of wrap it all up and get our final thoughts. So they continue to fight as the refs try and pull them apart after the DQ. Heyman finally gets in there and reasons with Brock to get out of there before, you know, things get worse. So they head up the ramp. Taker goes after him on the ramp and ends up throwing him through the glass in the entranceway in the Unforgiven kind of. And the set, they have like a big glass thing that says Unforgiven on it. He throws Brock through that, and we kind of go off the air with that, with Taker kind of standing bloody after he throws Brock through the glass. And that's kind of how we go off the air. Now, I'm with you in that this is another one I was talking about earlier where I feel like, I thought they did a very good match throughout this. But I'm with you in that I don't mind the non-finish. I'm fine with Brock not winning. which I feel like is a big criticism of this, because the big story behind this is Taker didn't want to put him over, yada yada yada, whatever. Which I think with hindsight, I don't pay much mind to it, because I think if you're going for a multi-match feud, which they are, and we already know where it's going, so it's hard to really judge them on that, knowing that if the plan was to do what they do next month, then that's fine. I'm okay with him not winning, because, you know, if he just beats Undertaker here, it would kind of not, what would be the reason for the Hell in the Cell? Like, you know, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. So I'm fine with that. That said, I'm with you on the way the DQ was executed. Like, it came off as very weak. This guy, like, Brian Hebner's been getting his ass, you know, handed to him the whole thing. And then one little, it's too sudden. Like, you can't do it like that, because you're just cutting the crowd off when you've worked him into a frenzy. I feel like they would have been better off, because I don't know if the Matt Hardy stuff, I think that was kind of their original plan. And I don't know if that really worked either, because I feel like that kind of, if just like goober Matt Hardy runs in and like ends the match, I think the crowd gets pretty annoyed at that too. I don't know why you don't just do the whole post-match thing, but it's like, because you kind of built through the whole match, like they just keep getting more and more intense and both guys are bloody. Just have them kind of battle out on the ramp. They both get counted out. Taker throws them through the glass. At least you have that cool spot to finish it. And you just feel like these two guys just are beating the hell out of each other, and they almost forgot what they were even doing because they got so caught up in beating the piss out of each other, you know?
Yeah, I agree 1,000%, Jake, because then you could say, well, you know, this ring and, like, you know, the ref couldn't hold him, but the cell's going to keep him in there, and just have that, you know, be the reason for the match, instead of, like, oh, the ref, you know, Hebner with his slicked down 2002 hair wanted to get the fuck out the way. So
bangs.
Yeah. It's like he definitely was, like, dyeing his hair with, like, you know, with whatever, like, spraying that shit in his hair to make him look like Slim Shady. So,
yeah. So I think if you do something more like that, I don't think the crowd gets so disappointed, because I think what killed the crowd is you're still like in what feels like you're in the throes of the finish to this match, and the bell just comes out of nowhere. And I think with that, it just kind of completely cuts the crowd off, and that's what pissed them off so much. Like, I don't even think the crowd gets that pissed off with a non-finish, like if you don't have a winner, which, you know, I think as long as you, I just think it's the way they did it. Like I said earlier with the, I forget which match we're talking about, with the Triple H match, or the Flair one too. Like, it's a good idea in essence. It's just they execute in a really weird way that's going to piss off the crowd and be kind of deflating. And so it kind of hurts the match. But overall, I thought it was a really awesome slugfest, like a big man battle. I think it gets a little bit forgotten, I think, because of the finish and, you know, all the stuff about, because I think this is heavily, you know, the big story with the match is Taker wouldn't put him over and all that. I think because of all those factors, I think this one gets overlooked, and the match that they have next month, it's kind of so well regarded that this one gets buried a bit. But I thought this one was still pretty good. It's a good big man battle. I thought it fit the story, especially if this is going to be like your chapter one or part one of Brock being tested and kind of not really being in a match of this kind of intensity and violence before, not really knowing how to do it. So he really couldn't pull it out. I thought the crowd was really with them throughout the whole thing.
Oh, but crowd was super hot.
Yeah, so I did dock it for the finish, but I went 3.25 on it, which I think is higher than most of what I've seen from this match. But I don't dock it of Brock not going over, because you're telling a multi-match kind of story to it. I thought it fit sort of what they were going in with Brock never being tested. It just, I think without that crappy finish, I think it elevates to something more like into the very good to great range. Like, I think if you just have them beating the shit out of each other on the ramp and it just ends with Brock going through the glass, so they have to throw the match out. And like you said, it would justify the sell. I think it would just work out much better than the ref just deciding, like, well, I've had enough of this shit. And then he just rings the bell. It's kind of a shitty finish. But
yeah, it really is. Uh-huh. I went 3.25 as well. I'm mm-hmm. shocked that people went lower on this match, because it's just another, like, you know, I know they have matches in the 2000s. I mean, the WrestleMania 30 match wasn't that great, but that's because Lesnar almost killed him like 5 minutes into the match. But I enjoyed their other matches that they had. They've always had like another one that I thought really had really good chemistry.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this match, you know, it could have just been when people were watching it, because I think it's a different experience watching them, how I'm doing for this pod like 20 years later. it's a whole different, like you just have different eyes when you watch this stuff. But I just think a lot of people were so involved with, you know, the backstage stuff. And I think it kind of paints people's view of the match maybe. But yeah, I think it's underrated. I've seen people go like under two on this match, which I thought that kind of shocked me. I mean, I think
wow.
I mean, I guess if you really want to like crap on it because of the finish, but I think even with the finish, I think the finish just holds it back from being great. But I still think it's pretty good. It's awesome kind of violent war. But yeah, anyway, so we're kind of locked in on that one too. So, but that's how we end the show. Overall thoughts on this one? Kind of a weird show to rate, Scott. What'd you think?
Yeah, it had its ups and its downs. Like I actually said, like this is a perfect example of 2002 WWE that has like stuff that's really great and then stuff that's like, why am I still watching wrestling? I think I'm gonna go like 6.5, 7 out of 10, just because of how good like the SmackDown matches were. Like SmackDown carried this show, besides the Raw match at the start.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. So we're pretty locked on this too. It's a tough one because even it has a lot of things that the RVD Triple H match is really disappointing, and the Brock Taker match is good, but the finishes on this kind of it makes it hard to rate because you have some good matches. Like even Flair Jericho, I thought was a pretty good match, but then it gets weird with the finish. So it's hard to rate. So I went 6.5 because I just felt it should be under the, I feel like 7 is where I start getting into your like very good shows into great shows. And I feel like it's just a touch under that, but I still think it was a pretty fun show. You have some good matches. You have the Benoit angle match and the Edge Eddie match that are both really good. I enjoyed the main event a good deal. I thought it's a solid setup for where they're going to go next month. The only real, the big kind of, it's the RVD Triple H match is really disappointing. I feel like that's sort of the albatross on this whole show.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Imagine that Triple H match in 2002 sucking. So
we'll see how it goes. But so we're pretty locked in with that. I'll go 6.5. You said 6.5, 7. So a good, if not very good or great show. But it's one I would check out. But anyway, best match. I think we both have Benoit Angle.
Hands down.
Best moment. I usually go with something outside of the, like something that happened outside of the ring. But for this one, it seems a little tough. I'll probably go with maybe Brock getting thrown through the glass. Possibly. I don't know. This is a weird one for moments.
Yeah, I'll either, you know, him getting thrown through that glass or, you know, that reverse German suplex and Angle selling is just amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot. If you want to go for, like, spots in a match, or you could even say the finish to Edge Eddie, that sick, the way he just drilled his head on that powerbomb, that was sick too. So if you're going, like, a ton of spots, there's a few good spots in the matches. If you're going for, like, something that's not, like, a move in ring, I'd probably go Brock getting thrown through the glass. Anyway, LVP on this one, I think I'm going to have to go Triple H, unfortunately.
Can I have it be a tie with Triple H and RVD? Because RVD didn't really seem to bring it for, like, you know, quote-unquote, main event.
I guess, yeah, I don't think it was a great performance by him either. But I do feel is that Triple H, like, heat segment is really what kind of derailed them. So, but I agree. You can't put it all on him. They were both in there. I don't think RVD looked his most motivated he's ever looked either. Maybe because he knew it was going down. Who knows? But MVP, who you got for MVP, Scott?
Oh. I'm gonna go with Taker, surprisingly. Yeah, that last match, you know, he looked like a monster and he made Brock look like a monster as well. And him trying to, you know, kill Lesnar with those chair shots.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna go with Kurt. He was in the best match and he was probably my favorite part of that match. I don't know. It's like when I don't have anybody else who really stands out to me and he's in the best match on the show, I'm probably gonna go Kurt because I just love everything he does.
Oh, he's amazing. Like I can't gush about him enough. Yeah.
Yeah, he's been on such a run. But I'd probably give an honorable mention to Eddie because all his stuff, I felt like he really carried the story of his match, and he was excellent then too, and how deliberate and awesome he was in there. But yeah, a lot of good matches on this show. Just some
just from one side.
Yes, yeah, definitely the SmackDown. So we normally don't do this on pay-per-views, but if we were to say the better showing of the two brands, I think we're going SmackDown as far as showings on the pay-per-view.
Yes.
Yes. All right, so that kind of wraps us up. We'll skip the top five since the pay-per-view. We didn't get that many people on the show. All right, so that was a lot of fun, Scott. Do you have anything that you would like to plug before we get out of here?
Yeah, you mentioned at the top, Blockbuster Rewind. I do that monthly with Eric Eels and Andy Atherton. The one for this month is the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. That's on the PTB and Pop Experience. Also on PTB and Pop Experience, I'm with Pop Goes to the Couch with Tim Capel, Sean Kidd, and Andy Atherton. We're hitting the Loki series that's currently airing right now. I've enjoyed those episodes. Those episodes have been a lot of fun. I'm also on the Pop Experience Battlestar in the 25th Century with Sean Kidd. We're going through and watching the original Battlestar Galactica and Buck Rogers. Sean has seen them multiple times. I'm seeing them for fresh eyes. They're not as bad as you would think, Jake. So with that, and I'm actually started a wrestling podcast with yours truly, Logan Crossland and Sean Kidd, PTBN YouTube Roulette, where every month one of us takes over and picks four random matches, and we've already done two episodes of that, and we've hit the most random matches I think we've ever seen. On the last episode I hosted, and we saw a Steiner's Brothers versus Dudley, who looks like a Cactus Jack reject, and a Vampire Warrior from ECW. It's tons of fun, and I can be found on Twitter at Scott_Shiflett.
Perfect. Yeah, that's a great pod. Definitely check it out. I feel like we're making a conscious effort to find matches to watch that are kind of out, maybe even out of our own wheelhouse, stuff that we've never seen, to make sure it's fresh stuff we're watching, and that we're kind of talking about stuff that people maybe haven't seen. But it's a lot of fun. It's entertaining to do the live watch format. It's a very informal. We just kind of screw around for four matches. It's a lot of fun. But thanks for coming on, Scott. As always, you're one of my most frequent guests and one of my favorite guests. I always talk about. I had a lot of fun discussing the show with you. As always, check out everything we have here on the North-South Connection feed. We have tons of shows dropping every day on various eras of wrestling. We have reactions to live wrestling events, like present-day wrestling events as they happen. Reaction shows that go up within the same night. They'll be up the morning after the show, so you can check that out. If there's anybody, like I said, SmackDown seems to be funnily into Peacock. So if you that was maybe a reason why you were not following the pod as much anymore, it's coming back up. So stick with me because we have a lot of cool stuff coming up, a lot of interesting stuff in this fall of 2002 run. And I also want to say, if there's anybody who listens and you want to come on and do and guest on an episode, just hit me up, Jambalaya_Jake, DM me, and we'll work it out. You can come on the show and talk a week of TV with me if you want. But other than that, I'm Jambalaya Jake. I'll see you in 2 weeks, where we will head to the fallout and start the build towards No Mercy 2002. So for myself and Scott, that's it. We're out. Space out, everything.
everything slows you down, and all colors that surround you are bleeding to one. Only thing you really need, just a way to find the speed that then you will achieve, escape velocity. Is not enough. Nobody gave it up. I'm not the kind to lay down and die. Adrenaline keeps me in the game. Adrenaline, you don't even feel the pain. Wilder than your wildest dreams. When you're going too soon, you taste adrenaline. You know.